Half-Guarded Hour is recorded before a live studio audience.
Comrade Coughlin, how are you doing?
I'm good, James. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Pleasure to be on your program.
Yeah, can you actually see me right now?
I'm just seeing a little light blue icon at the moment.
That's fine. I'm only doing the audio thing, I think. I don't know how this stuff works. I'm lucky to get it working.
Hey, it's all you can hope for sometimes.
It's good to have you on the show. I don't give a shit. We're already recording. Well, technically it's recording. I don't know when I'll edit it. But, yeah, I wanted to specifically get you on the show. Oh, fuck it, let's start the show. Hey, everybody, welcome to the Half-Guarded Hour here at HalfGuarded.com. I'm Mike Coughlin, and we are here with James Swift, as you've already seen when you read the blurb. James, say hello to everybody.
It's a pleasure to be out there with all your fans, Mike.
Yes, all three of you listening will be very, very happy to have an actual real journalist on the program. And that's part of the reason I wanted to have James on here is because you are a real journalist. Isn't that correct?
That is true. I'm a journalist to some degree. Before I started working for Half Guarded, I've been doing a whole bunch of stuff in the Metro Atlanta area. I won a couple of awards from the National Press Club for some of my writing in the juvenile justice and covering Southern poverty. So I've been around the block a few times.
Yeah, and I will say that obviously I love all the writers at HalfGuarded.com, but you have actually kind of embodied, I think, the spirit of the site in that, yes, you have a piece that came out today on Brock Lesnar and Mark Hunt. We have another one coming up next day or two whenever I decide to publish it on superhero movies. But you've also done really good work as far as, like, talking about tuition fees and things of that nature, which, you know, people aren't really talking about. And you were the first person to ever write anything semi-political, I think, with the website, in that, you know, back last August you wrote about Donald Trump and the death of the GOP, and I was like, that's kind of very prescient nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I firmly believe in the idea of mesoholism, that all things have a certain commonness. So, you know, even if you're writing about mixed martial arts or Spider-Man movies, it always ties into, you know, these greater socio-political things that we're seeing, you know, across the cultural spectrum. So, I mean, it's just part and parcel of what I do. I just love writing. I love covering as many, you know, diverse topics as I can. And, you know, Half-Guarded is a really great platform to discuss, you know, obviously not just mixed martial arts, but, you know, the entire, you know, Western civilization experience. And I really got to thank you for that opportunity.
Hell, the pleasure's all mine. I just realized my drink is sitting across the room, and I can't get it without moving. So I'm going to let you say, tell everybody a little bit about your thoughts on Brock Lesnar versus Mark Hunt, and I'll be back like in 10 seconds.
Oh, absolutely. Well, obviously, you know, even before the Brock Lesnar-Mark Hunt match was announced, just looking at the UFC 200 lineup, I mean, this is got to be one of the best UFC shows, you know, ever assembled, if not the absolute best. And I guess the whole Brock Lesnar thing is somewhat out of left field, and I'm not really sure exactly, you know, how this is going to work out long term. Obviously, there's some sort of working agreement with UFC and WWE about having Brock Lesnar show up for at least one show. If he defeats Mark Hunt, you know, does he come back for another show later on? Does he make the Madison Square Garden event come later this year? Mm-hmm. Just a lot of stuff we really don't know, or at least things that have not been publicized yet. But really, you know, I think it's a very interesting thing that's going on here, because even though you want to look at this fight and kind of, you know, write it off as a freak show fight, something like maybe you'd see like back in the day of, you know, Pride FC or, you know, any of the Japanese organizations that came out, you know, post-2007. But really, you look at Mark Hunt, you look at Brock Lesnar, and you look at just how watered down the heavyweight division is now. I mean, you know, even heading this match right now, both these guys could easily be considered top 10 heavyweights in the world. And I think there is a very strong, you know, argument to be made that whoever wins this fight would be a top 5 heavyweight.
Yeah, it's for the record, everybody, I'm obviously back in my alcoholic state, not really alcoholic, but yeah, it's funny because they kind of Again, all the details are unknown to most people. Maybe Ariel Helwani knows, and we'll get to Ariel in a bit. But, you know, I had heard about this, and I kind of done a little bit of cryptic texting or tweeting about it back in April that, like, Brock might be back at UFC 200. But, you know, when things came and went, I'm like, well, okay, maybe it wouldn't. And all of a sudden, here we are a month out, and he's returning, against a guy that is beatable, but is by no means a gimme. Like, they did not just, like, take... I'm sure if Frank Mir was available, that would have been the best choice, but Mark Hunt is, you know, he's a beast. That's a dude that can just knock a guy out, obviously, at any time with one punch, and Brock has never really liked getting hit. So, you know, you got to give credit to Brock, whether he's just doing it for a paycheck or not. That's a lot of money to step in there with a guy like Mark Hunt.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, it would have been so easy for the UFC to pull in a guy like, you know, Dad Out 5000 for a fight like this. Just something so freaky. But, you know, Mark Hunt, obviously, he's the real deal. I mean, you go back and you even watch his K-1 stuff. I mean, that fight against Ray Sefo is like one of the all-time just, you know, monster match fights ever.
You are speaking to my heart. I have that. It's one of the phone. I've had that fight on my iPhone since I first got an iPhone in 2007. Like, I've always had, it just, when Hunt drops his hands, he's like, let's go, just keep hitting me, and I'm just watching him eat the punches. I know there's a little bit of a gimmick to it, but it's still incredible to watch those two guys just slug it out.
Yeah, and, you know, Brock Lesnar is willingly stepping into the octagon to fight a dude who has a head like a cannonball. You know, it's a very dangerous matchup for Lesnar, and, you know, if you're Vince McMahon or, you know, his WWE handlers, I mean, you at least have to kind of go into something like this wondering, you know, okay, you know, what could be the worst-case scenario here? You know, does he get hurt? You know, Mark Hunt, not really known for his submissions, but, you know, it's obvious by what we saw with Dan Henderson and Michael Bisping, UFC 199, anything can happen. So, like I said, I mean, it's just a really great matchup. It should be absolutely entertaining and, you know, probably won't be a three-round war of attrition, but, you know, sometimes you don't want to watch technical showpieces. You want to watch guys go in there and give each other brain damage, and hopefully this match will deliver that and more.
Exactly. I think especially when you look at the whole UFC 200 card, when you got, like, Frankie Edgar and Jose Aldo, which is basically about the pinnacle of pure technique, you have Jon Jones, Daniel Cormier, who are as good a light heavyweight as you ever going to have something like Lesnar and Hunt, to just, it's like, it's part freak show, but it's also, too, I mean, we're talking one of the best wrestlers, realistically, in the past 20 years in America, in Brock Lesnar, and Mark Hunt is one of the all-time great knockout artists, and who have both had very, very legitimate fighting careers, and here they are going at it, and it's a testament, I think, to Brock that he could be out since 2011, and I still think, well, he can win this fight. Like, there's not too many other heavyweights to take 4.5 years off and you would give them any kind of chance against Mark Hunt.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as much as, you know, the MMA, you know, global audience out there likes to kind of crap on Brock Lesnar as being a media creation, I mean, the dude went in there and he's absolutely just killed, you know, all-time legends. I mean, he destroyed Randy Couture. He beat up Frank Mir. He went in there against a very, very good and steroided up Shane Carwin and beat him.
And allegedly.
I mean, yeah, obviously. You know, we talk about Brock Lesnar having the bad shin from the Cain Velasquez fight, but you go back and you watch the Shane Carwin fight, I mean, that dude took a beating and came back. So I think, at least to a certain extent, Lesnar's stamina and endurance is a little bit underrated. And I think that could fare up pretty well in a fight against Mark Hunt.
Yeah, I always look at the Carwin fight as like the ultimate proof that Brock Lesnar, no matter what people want to say, is mentally, he's not a quitter. Like, his body might quit on him, like when he gets hit by body shots. I don't think he likes getting hit, but he took a beating from Shane Carwin that most people never would have survived, and he did not quit. That man's will to win, for as much of a cliche as it is in sports, Brock Lesnar has that thing within him where he would not quit, and he showed it and then some against Shane Carwin.
Yeah, I mean, really, the only time I've actually seen Brock Lesnar look, you know, really bad and out of shape in a fight was the one against Alistair Overeem. But, I mean, that was, like, what, after a year layoff from the verticultus, he clearly wanted to retire. He just wasn't feeling it. But, you know, you watch Brock Lesnar's prime. You go back to UFC 100, and he's the fight against Frank Mir. I mean, when the dude's running on all cylinders, he's a force to be reckoned with. And I'm not really sure what kind of Brock Lesnar we're going to see. I haven't been keeping up with the WWE stuff for quite a while. So I'm assuming, you know, he's still in pretty good athletic shape. But, you know, like I said, it's an interesting matchup. You really can't come out and say, you know, that Mark Hunt has been going there and just absolutely just waylay Lesnar. It's going to be an embarrassment. There's a very strong chance Lesnar could win this fight. There's a very strong chance he could lose the fight. And it's just one of those things where you just can't wait to see it. I mean, it could go either way. And, you know, no matter how it ends, you know it's going to be explosive. And it's just one of those fights where, you know, it just totally made my summer knowing that I have this waiting for me in a couple of weeks.
You know, it really speaks volumes about who Brock Lesnar is and how we view him in the general public, I guess, that he was announced on the same day that they announced Conor versus Nate Diaz, too, on the same show. And that Conor versus Nate was one of the, if not biggest, pay-per-views in UFC history, and no one's talking about it. Everybody's talking about Brock still.
Yeah, definitely. A couple of months ago, I did an article, Half Guarded, kind of outlining some of the problems the UFC was having about not being able to build stars. And, you know, you have Conor McGregor, you have Ronda Rousey, and I think right now we're kind of seeing a resurgence. Without question, this is the best time to be a UFC fan since 2010. Probably the best year UFC's had since 2007. You just have so much talent. You know, every single division just has at least one very remarkable big name. And, you know, I don't know. It's one of those things where obviously, depending on how the fight between Mark Hunt and Brock Lesnar turns out, if Lesnar goes in there and just gets absolutely creamed, then, you know, maybe it won't be that big of a deal or an impact on the business. But let's say Lesnar goes in there and wins, and he wins decisively. He goes in there and he KOs Mark Hunt, or he submits him, you know, pretty easily. You know, what do you do? I mean, do you give him the winner of the Stipe Miocic Alistair Overeem fight? Do you try to get something booked for Madison Square Garden? Do you do that for the next big Super Bowl show? And to me, that really kind of opens the doors for, you know, so much entertaining booking. This could provide us, you know, at least a solid year of, you know, different storylines and potential heavyweight matchups. And, you know, really win or lose, you're going to have something very interesting. And I think it's also going to do a lot of good for Mark Hunt, win or lose. If he goes in there and wins, he's the dude to beat up, you know, Brock Lesnar. Obviously, a lot of hardcore UFC fans hate Brock Lesnar just for being Brock Lesnar. So you kind of give him sort of a resurgence in his career path as well. So, I mean, really, unless, you know, the lighting rig falls in the cage during the fight, you know, this is a win-win for the UFC no matter really what happens.
Yeah, you know, it's absolutely true. It's like, it's remarkable because you look at, like, UFC 197 was obviously awesome, and 198 with John Jones and John Jones OSP, and not the biggest thing ever, whatever. But UFC 198 was Brazil. That was a great show. 199. I think it was one of the best shows I've ever seen. 200 looks, I mean, I was looking at the card today, and almost every single fight on that show could headline a UFC card. Maybe not a pay-per-view, but it is ridiculously deep, and we still have Conor and Nate, too. We still have whatever they're going to do at Madison Square Garden, Ronda Rousey coming back. Like, if people aren't fight fans right now, like, I don't know what else anybody who watches fighting could want. Like, every week it seems like we are seeing something great. I mean, hell, we just had Cody Garbrandt and Thomas Almeida, and that was on for free, and that was in a really high-level matchup between 235-pounders, and people kind of have forgotten it already, and that just says how deep things are right now in the UFC.
Yeah, I mean, you look at UFC 200, this is a show where Rafael Asukawa is taking on TJ Dillashaw on, like, a Fox Sports 1 show. I mean, the fact that you have a card that is that stacked, I mean, like you said, literally every fight on this show could headline at least, a Fox Sports 1 program.
You look at TJ, sorry to cut you off, but TJ and Asuncao, I mean, if Dominic Cruz hadn't come back, that's a pay-per-view main event. They would have for sure been fighting for the Bantamweight Championship on pay-per-view. And meanwhile, like, yeah, they're on Fox Sports 1, and you got fights like, Takanori Gomi, Diego Sanchez, and a bunch of other guys are all on, and Jim Miller and such, are on Fight Pass. It's crazy how deep this show is.
Yeah, it's also a very good mix of, you know, older veteran talent and a lot of up-and-comers. I mean, you got Sage Northcutt on the show. You've got John Jones, you've got Daniel Cormier, you've got all these guys who are really the past, present, and future on one show. And if this thing isn't, you know, at least as good as something like Pride 32, then I really don't know what to do as an MMA fan anymore. If this sucks, then I think civilization is doomed.
And if you're the UFC, everything that comes out of it is just golden, pretty much. Like, no matter if it's Frankie or Jose, you have a huge contender for Conor McGregor. If Brock or, you know, Hunt wins, either one of them could fight Stipe, or you still have, you know, that'd be great. You still have Anthony Johnson, who, you know, will be fighting actually here in Chicago in July against, you know, Cormier and Jones. You have Misha Tate and Emmanuel Nunes, which is the only real risk if Nunes wins. But otherwise, you know, you have Tate versus Holm or Tate versus Rousey. I mean, it's just obviously Cain Velasquez is the opening fight against Travis Brown on the pay-per-view. That's how crazy deep this card is.
And, you know, one of the things that I know we're all excited about the UFC event card as is, but as we all know, a lot of times fighters, you know, get hurt on the lead up to a pay-per-view. And obviously with something, you know, this stacked, you don't want to see a guy go down. But, you know, what happens, just throwing out here as devil's advocate, you know, did Mark Hunt, you know, 2 weeks ahead of the fight, you know, pulls a groin muscle or something? I mean, what do? You have Brock Lesnar there without an opponent. Do you give him Cain Velasquez? Do you give him a Junior Dos Santos? Do you give him maybe even some light heavyweight fighter? And, you know, really just looking at the show top to bottom, I mean, it's so stacked that even if you have one of the, you know, main pay-per-view card fighters go down, there's at least one other person already booked who could easily step up, you know, to be that big pay-per-view fight. And I think it's really just a brilliant marketing move by Dana White and company.
Yeah, it's actually kind of wrote about that a little bit when the news earlier today. There's that rumor that Jose Aldo had been injured. And I wrote that, you know, if Jose Aldo and Frankie Edgar doesn't happen, that doesn't really matter because that fight, as incredible as it is scheduled right now to be fourth from the top. It's barely on the pay-per-view. And so, you know, if Hunt gets injured or Brock gets injured, you can just slide in Cain Velasquez or Travis Brown or, you know, anybody anywhere. I mean, golly, you could just, craziest thing of all could be, you know, John Jones versus Brock Lesnar. And that could very well happen. It seems kind of crazy, but I've seen way crazier things happen in this sport.
Yeah, without question. I mean, that was a thought I was thinking about on the ride home today. It's like, well, you know, what would happen if, you know, Daniel Cormier gets a coward flu again and you got to bring in Brock Lesnar? I mean, there's just so many possibilities here that even as good as the card is now, I think there's still possibly an outside chance that, you know, fortune could shine upon us and give something even crazier. And, you know, it's just another great show. I really am looking forward to it. It's one of those things where I haven't really been this excited about an MMA card in, oh God, 6, 7, 8 years. And it really is a Super Bowl kind of feel, you know, leading up to it. You know, if you're a fight fan, if you're an old-time guy like me who remembers watching UFC 1 on a pay-per-view fuzz, you're obviously going to be into it. And if you're more of a neophyte fan, I mean, you got everything you'd hope for. You get to see pretty much every weight division, every marquee star. It's just going to be great, and I really can't wait for it. It's like the World Cup, Super Bowl, Stanley Cup, all rolled into one for me.
Yeah, to me it was like, I thought UFC 200 was, like, I looked at the card a week ago, and I thought, this is amazing. They have booked a card worthy of UFC 200, and then they added Brock Lesnar, and suddenly I'm like, oh wait, no, now it's worth being called UFC 200. They are truly putting on the biggest show ever, and they are not using Conor or Ronda. And that says a lot about what the UFC has done this far as far as promoting and building up different kinds of stars.
Yeah, definitely. Just looking at the fight, I'm so happy that the main event is John Jones versus Daniel Cormier. Because really, these two guys, I think maybe pound for pound, are the two best fighters on the planet right now, and you're getting them. It's really great to have Brock Lesnar and all these other guys on the show, but you also, for something like this where it's a showcase of the absolute best sport has to offer, you have to have these marquee guys on there. I mean, no offense to Ronda Rousey, no offense to Conor McGregor, no offense to, you know, even somebody like Demetrius Johnson, who I think is probably third or fourth pound for pound in the world. you got to have John Jones and Daniel Cormier up front and center showing you the absolute best the sport has to offer. And I think that's one of those things where, you know, as awesome as that fight is, it's probably going to sort of lose a little bit of relevance with all the Brock Lesnar news, and maybe it's in the build-up for McGregor Diaz too, and whatever news comes up about Ronda Rousey, you know, her second fight or her latest fight coming up. So just something to kind of keep in mind, I think, is, you know, even though Brock Lesnar is a huge deal, the main event is the main event for a purpose, because that really is just epitomizing everything great about MMA in the 21st century.
You know, you're absolutely right. You have the two guys who are unquestionably the two top guys at their weight. There's nobody in the stretch. Nobody's close to Jones and Cormier, and they have a genuine grudge match that is not manufactured. It's like everything you could ever want in life. This is, you know, Patriots versus Colts. This is Giants, Dodgers, Red Sox, Yankees. Only they get to beat the hell out of each other. And, like, I'm turning into Joe Rogan, where I'm just, like, shaking my head, like, this is so awesome that we get to see this. What a fucking time to be alive. Please don't sell the company, Dana.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the only way this can get better is if you bring in, like, Fedor Emelianenko to be the special guest referee.
And he'll be fighting in 2 weeks on UFC Fight Pass because Bellator's incompetent.
Well, there you go. Just what we need. And obviously, you know, the big fight that we've been wanting to see for years and years, I mean, since we've already had Mayweather and Pacquiao, what do you think the odds are of getting us a Lesnar-Fedor showdown before the end of the year?
I would guess probably not going to happen. I suspect that, you know, Fedor's going to be on UFC Fight Pass because he's fighting on that weird Russian promotion, which I'm convinced is a money laundering front. But I would guess that his, like, North American rights on regular TV and pay-per-view are secured by Bellator. But then again, I have everything that involves Bellator, Ryzen, Fedor, like, none of this stuff makes any sense. It's weird to think that, you know, Fedor's handlers have fucked this up to the degree they have, because there have been so many gigantic fights that they've blown. And it was, you know, if it was against Randy Couture or against Brock or against, you know, a rematch with Verdum, any of these fights would have been gigantic. And instead, he was in Russia and he's fighting Jeff Monson, and he's fighting Jadeep Singh in Japan. And it's like, I don't know if they really understand just how much money they could have made if he had just fought in the UFC. And it's sad, but at the end of the day, you know, I mean, from just a pure sports perspective, I don't really care anymore. I think Fedor's done. I think he's been done for a long, long time. But there is, you know, your brain can tell you one thing and your heart tells you another, and it's really tough to just kind of forget all those years where he was the greatest in the world. Like, he was just running through Nogueira. He ran through Krokop. He hit Heath Herring with punches that are so sickening that it makes you, you know, want to vomit for Heath Herring. Like, he was the scariest dude in the world, and that takes a long time to go away, and especially, you know, time heals all wounds, and he hasn't lost in a while, and you kind of forget, oh yeah, Dan Henderson knocked him out, and Bigfoot Silva dominated him, things like that. So, you know, I wouldn't mind seeing him come back, but something tells me crazy Russians just are too difficult to deal with these days.
You know what, I will settle with GSP as the referee in that case.
And hey, and that's the other thing. Well, GSP is rumored to be coming back. And George St. Pierre coming back, what would be the ideal time for him? The UFC's debut, Madison Square Garden, bring back their greatest legend. He's obviously been known to be training. I mean, goddamn, the fact that George St. Pierre might return this year, and it wouldn't even be necessarily the top two or three biggest stories for the UFC, says a lot about where this company's at.
I mean, yeah, definitely. We're going to have a show coming up by the end of the year with CM Punk as probably a headliner, which is going to be bigger than probably any boxing matchup we have this year. I mean, everything the UFC is doing right now is just absolutely at a top level. You know, I've never really seen the company delivering a product this consistently great. And, you know, I'm just going to enjoy it while it lasts. I mean, eventually you're going to kind of hit a doldrum again. There was that big funk in 2011 when a lot of fighters got injured. There are so many layoffs, and I think now we're kind of hitting, you know, if not, 2005 was the golden era, and 2010 was the Silver Age. I mean, we're knee-deep in probably the Bronze Age of MMA. It's a great time to be a fan. And if anyone out there has any complaints about, you know, what we're getting with UFC 200, UFC 202, I mean, even a show like UFC 201, which is going to fall through the cracks, and you have, you know, a great fight with Demetrius Johnson, you've got a great fight with Robbie Lawler taking on Tyrone Woodley. I mean, there's just so much great stuff going on out there that I just don't know where I'm going to really kind of withhold my excitement for all the stuff we have coming up.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, again, as a practicing attorney, some part of my job, my life, my brain is to I try to see things from other people's point of view, but I don't know how anybody could, like, not be so happy right now where almost every weekend or every other weekend the UFC, and sometimes Bellator, you know, there's just so much great stuff on all the time. Like, this is what we've always wanted. People look at the old days when there was, like, a pay-per-view every 2 or 3 months and they would be kind of be stacked, or people thought they were stacked, and, oh, the UFC spread itself too thin, and now I'm looking at cards where, again, last Saturday at UFC 199, almost every fight in that card was incredible. I mean, it opened up with a fight of the year candidate, and it closed with one of the greatest stories ever in a dude like Michael Bisping winning, and that will be forgotten in a couple of weeks when UFC 200 comes around. It's crazy.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know. It's just, I think it's really sort of a perfect storm where you just have sort of the perfect balance of older talent really coming back into their own, having their career resurgences, while you're also having all these up-and-comers. You know, the guys are going to be selling pay-per-views for the next, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, all kind of coming together in this really great bottleneck. I mean, we've got a point in time where we're able to watch Anderson Silva, Brock Lesnar, you know, BJ Penn, if he ever can pass a drug test, all these great fighters of the old guard who are still fighting, while at the same time we're watching guys like Sage Northcutt, we're watching guys like Stephen Thompson, great, great fighter.
Fuck yeah. I mean, fucking Stephen Thompson and Rory McDonald are going to fight in like 10 or 14 days, and everybody's kind of forgotten about it, and that's like, that's incredible. Those two guys are like next generation super duper. This is what MMA should be. And we're all forgetting about that they're fighting. That's how great things are right now.
I mean, I would give Dana a lot more money if I could.
Well, I wouldn't give
no way around it.
I wouldn't give him much more. I think he's got enough. And, you know, he's had his issues. And it's funny because all this, and we've already talked like a half hour because when I get going at MMA, it just doesn't stop. And the main reason, though, like I said earlier on in the show, was I wanted to have you on is because you are a professional. You've been trained in journalism. I, before I went into the awful world of law at the University of Iowa, I had a minor in journalism. And I see it as a very special profession. And I think it's one that gets perverted. Too many guys, it seems like the days of, you're supposed to report the news, not make the news, not give your opinion, are gone. And we're in this era of opinion journalism, which leads me to Ariel Helwani and his like 24-hour banning from the UFC. And I don't know if you watched or heard any of Ariel on his own podcast talking about it, but all these people rushing to his defense, acting like the UFC committed the greatest sin of all time by not basically giving him a free ticket to sit cage side. So where do you fall? Like, when you saw all this happening, what was like your initial response to how the UFC handled it and to how Ariel and the rest of the media handled it?
Well, you know, the obvious thing here is the ability for Ariel Helwani and really any reporter to get covered the UFC is extremely limited because, of course, they're a private company. They reserve the right. They give you the media pass, and you're pretty much beholden to the same standards they would have for any other ticket purchaser. You don't have the same sort of, you know, protections that you would have as a reporter if you were covering a city event or a public event or some sort of governmental events or affair. So really, I mean, whatever the UFC says goes. The protections you have as a reporter are very limited. And the same thing applies pretty much all the other sports. It applies to the NFL, NHL, NBA, MLB. Basically, you go into these things and you pretty much play by whatever their rules are. You report what you can report. If you have some sort of structured deal with an organization like the UFC or any other, you know, sports promotion, I mean, usually there is a pretty strict guideline for what you can do. I've covered a lot of organizations over the years, not necessarily sports, but some, you know, private companies, some non-governmental organizations, where there are very clear-cut things that they list in their requirements for when you do stories about them. And I'm pretty sure that if you're going to get a media pass in the UFC or you're going to do any amount of extensive coverage, you're going to have to fill out some sort of paperwork. You're going to have a form. You're going to have at least some sort of limited contract. Pretty much the same way you get when you sign a contract to buy a ticket to a UFC show. I mean, you agree to follow a certain set of rules, and if you don't follow these rules, then it can be revoked at any time. Now, I'm not really sure exactly what the official UFC paperwork is.
Actually, I can jump in on that because I've been credentialed, like I wrote the other day, yesterday. I don't even know how many times I've been credentialed. And I can tell you that it's your basic standard. You have agreed to abide by being a professional. Like, there's nothing in there that says you can't say this or can't say that. There's now a dress code in play because certain people didn't dress properly. I'm not going to name any names, Ed in San Antonio. You know, for the most part, it's like, you know, you have to be they expect people to come in there and be professional. And Ariel, to his credit, is a professional. Like, I've never seen him act inappropriately. I've had dinner with him. I say dinner, but we sat around the media room just eating. I always like to joke, Dana White bought me dinner. That's always my favorite little line there. But, you know, when I'm there, it's not, like, as much fun as it is, that, like, I stopped having this overwhelming joy of going to the UFC kind of in about 2006. And nowadays I go to shows if they're in the Chicago area or the Midwest because I think it's like an obligation to do so. But it's not what people think. Like, I put on nice clothes. I show up. I show up early. I'm respectful. I take my seat. I go out of my way to never try to show any emotion when I sit in press row. And that can be really tough because I can remember, you know, when Anthony Pettis beat Ben Henderson in Milwaukee. It was a great show. And I always put the disclaimer out because I think so many journalists don't. And it really bothers me when they have personal relationships with fighters or anybody in the fight game and they don't disclose that. But one of my good friends is the lead jiu-jitsu coach for Duke Rufus and Anthony Pettis. And so when Pettis won, I was like, I wanted to jump up and scream and be like, my gosh, my friend helped that happen. That's just so awesome. And instead, I'm just sitting there gripping my computer saying, all right, Anthony Pettis has just won the world championship by armbar, and I'm just, you know, I have to go into like that alternate, you know, leave your body, you're no longer a fan, you have to be a journalist thing. And I've seen journalists in press row cheering and clapping, and it's kind of disgusting. Like, the MMA media really is not very disciplined, and I would imagine way less so compared to, you know, whoever the beat reporter is for the Chicago Cubs or whatever. Like, those guys are truly trained, and unfortunately, I think there's been so little, there are so few actual journalists in MMA, and I think that they just think, oh, well, you know, I can do whatever I want. The UFC should just give me everything I want, and they don't understand, like, journalists aren't, nobody likes a journalist. It's like being a lawyer, like, nobody likes you. Your job is not to be liked. Like, you've probably written stuff where you knew that the moment you hit send, you were going to get crapped on. When you wrote about tuition fees at your alma mater, like, you wrote that knowing on some level that somebody might read that and go, hey, let's call this kid in here and give him crap because what is he talking about? And, you know, and I've done that myself. Like, I look at something, and I think it makes you a better journalist to know that somebody's going to be questioning it. You go, is this accurate? But at the end of the day, like, you either are a journalist or you're a shill. And I think some of these guys think that they can just do whatever they want and the UFC will just roll over, and they don't understand one of these companies is worth $4 billion and the other one is a person making maybe $40,000 a year if they're lucky.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's one of those things where when you look at MMA as a sport, it's still the new kid on the block. I mean, there still isn't an official Associated Press guideline for how you're supposed to cover a mixed martial arts event, same way you cover other professional sports. And, you know, looking out there, I mean, there's plenty of great MMA journalists. Probably one of the biggest influences on me, not just as someone covering MMA, but just as a reporter in general, Dave Meltzer. I mean, one of the best, you know, all-around reporters you'll find anywhere. I mean, he's the epitome of a great beat reporter. You know, Kevin Iole over at Yahoo. I mean, these are very good, very solid, comprehensive writers. But I think at the same time, I mean, with the resurgence and popularity of mixed martial arts, you also have a lot of the new media types. Now, I don't want to name any particular sites, but there's a lot out there who I think really don't have the firmest grasp of what mixed martial arts is about. And because maybe they have that big name branding, they're getting guys out there who are going in there not really to kind of cover the event in the traditional sense, but just kind of go out there and put their corporate stamp on the event itself. But just as the conduct policy for reporters, I mean, personally, I've never kind of seen it as being an issue where maybe, you know, if I'm training with some of the fighters, that'd be one thing. But, you know, whenever I'm doing an assignment, especially something like that, it's just, you know, where it has to be pretty much instantaneous. You're doing a live report. I mean, every time I've done something like that, just the fear, you know, that absolute concentration on getting the story out there and being as accurate as possible supersedes whatever biases I might have. And I think, you know, if you're a hardcore professional journalist, that's pretty much built into your DNA. That's not something you have to worry about. But if you're one of these more new media type guys, one of the more clickbaity websites where you're just trying to kind of get that instant, you know, search engine optimized content out there, then, yeah, obviously you're going to have guys on press row who really shouldn't actually be out there covering the event the way some of the, you know, old guards in the media are.
Yeah, and I think that manifested itself in certain people. I look at Deadspin as the – it's easy to take a shot at Deadspin because Gawker and everybody's going to be gone pretty soon because Hulk Hogan defeated them, which is one of the craziest things that's ever happened in the history of the world. But, you know, they always bragged about not having media access, and then they made sure to mention, oh, but the UFC won't give us credentials, and then you read their stories, and everything is so – blatantly anti-UFC, and it's fine to be against the UFC. It's fine to say the UFC does things wrong. I mean, you know, something, if they screw up, I'm like, hey, I thought Dana handled the situation with Ariel wrong. I thought that he allowed his emotions to get the better of him, whether it's Dana or Lorenzo Fertitta, whomever it was. They should have just said nothing, done nothing, waited a day or two, and the next time he applied for credentials, just not issued them. And they could have got their point across that way, but they made a big show of it, and they turned Ariel into the story. And people don't like media, but the media is the one that controls the narrative. Like, they're the ones that get to go out there and give their side of everything, and the UFC really doesn't. Like, they have UFC Tonight, but they're not going to go on there and waste time talking about Ariel Helwani. And here we are, 48, 72 hours later, and it's all gone. Like, we had this giant story, but it really wasn't a giant story. I don't think regular people cared about it. I don't think most regular people give a crap about media members and coverage and access because they don't understand the importance and whatnot. And, you know, to them, it's like they wanted to hear about Brock Lesnar. They want to hear about Conor. And instead, all they heard was some guy didn't get, again, press credentials of the UFC is essentially a free ringside ticket. It's an awesome ticket, but nobody said Ariel couldn't talk to anyone. He wasn't, like, forbidden by the government from writing stories or doing his podcast or anything. And it seems like everybody was, like, trying to, like, create this crazy thing that had happened. And in reality, it's like, okay, he got escorted out of the building and his feelings were hurt. And I was like, why are your feelings hurt? Like, you're a journalist. Like, a lot of journalists are kind of proud when somebody kicks him out. Like, that's like the mark of a good journalist is the big bad wolf thinks that you're scum. Like, Woodward and Bernstein were enemies of Nixon, and they were proud of that.
Yeah, I mean, the really interesting thing about the whole Ariel Helwani little situation is that it doesn't really seem like it's that much of a detriment to the UFC. It's not like he's out there reporting about a big, you know, steroid cover-up. You know, as a guy who's done about half his career in public relations, about half his career in journalism, I mean, there's very much a symbiotic relationship between the two. And pretty much what happened with Helwani is he went in there and he kind of violated, you know, probably the biggest journalist public relations contract you can have, and that is the embargo breaker. And I think, you know, Helwani certainly deserves, if you're going to, you know, slot him for breaking the news early, yeah, he deserves a little bit of criticism for breaking the story early. But, I mean, he had to get confirmation from somebody in the UFC. I mean, there was some publicist, there was some high-ranking person, there was somebody who said, yes, we can confirm Brock Lesnar is coming back, and that kind of gave him the impetus to report it. You know, journalism is a cutthroat industry. You know, it's all about being first as opposed to being right. And I think this is one of those scenarios where, obviously, if you're Helwani, you want to get stuff out there first. You want to be the first guy to get listed on Google. You want to be the guy who's listed as the official source. And I think that's just the nature of the beast. It doesn't really matter what sort of aspect of journalism you're into, whether it's MMA or you're covering, you know, the Washington, D.C. beat. That's just something that, unfortunately, is part and parcel of the industry.
Having, that's actually really interesting. You mentioned having, you know, basically been on both sides, if you will, of the, we'll say, battle for information. I think it was Dave Scholler, who was one of the UFC's main press guys, but somebody from the UFC, said that Helwani should have had the professional courtesy to ask us first about this story before he ran it. And from your experience, would that have been the proper thing for Ariel to have done?
I think considering it would be the absolute biggest MMA story of the year, I mean, just from my personal experiences, I would at least try to get double confirmation from somebody. It's one of those things where you don't want to go out there and just kind of shoot the gun with something that, you know, BuzzFeed could post about Brock Lesnar. Obviously, you want to go out there and, you know, make sure you have, you know, double loaded, double down on what you're doing. And, you know, unfortunately, that's part of journalism. You've got to do that sometimes. I mean, sometimes you're giving, you know, exclusive information, and you have that relationship with the agency who's giving you that information, and you've got to play ball with them. And I think in this situation, you know, Helwani, he was, you know, privy to some really, really important, you know, data there, something that was very, very valuable to the company. And obviously, I think we all agree Dana White overreacts. He's a guy who does that. He's very impulsive. He makes decisions that he kind of goes back on very quickly. Keep in mind, this is the same guy who fired like half the roster in 2009. They were part of, what was it, the American Top Team?
Yeah.
John Fitch and all those guys.
Yeah, it's true.
So, I mean, it's one of those things where, at the end of the day, like you said earlier, I mean, it's Wednesday and it's completely a non-story. We've already forgotten about it. It's one of those things where, like, for 48 hours, it was a very controversial topic to a very, very niche sector of an already pretty niche sector of, you know, the global population. I mean, how many people are there on the planet? How many of them know who Ariel Helwani is? And of those, how many of them actually care? Nowhere near as many who care that Brock Lesnar is coming back. And, you know, I think it's just a little sidebar in history.
And to me, that's kind of one of the craziest things about all this. And I was talking to somebody earlier today, and I'm, you know, I always go out of my way to toot my own horn because if I don't, no one else will. But, you know, last year, and I've been pushing it, I wrote very, very extensively about the UFC's PED policy and some of the measures that are within it. And a lot of people have ignored it. Luke Thomas from MMA Fighting is not, and I credit him for giving a lot of attention. But I'm like, I went and actually did investigation. I went and read something and applied my legal knowledge, my journalistic knowledge, my half-witted brain that's still alive, and I was like, hey, there's something going on here. It's not like Helwani was doing anything like that. Like, he said, like, a couple hours before the UFC did, Brock Lesnar's coming back, and the number of people that saw that and was very minuscule, I'm sure, and even if they did see it, they see so much of this stuff from so many journalists, and maybe Helwani's always right 100% of the time, but I'm willing to bet that most people on Twitter and all that lump him in with every other journalist. We're like, ah, some guy said this and whatever. And then when the UFC breaks it, then it suddenly mattered. And it seemed like the UFC was just upset, I guess, that he broke the news a couple of hours before they did. But at the end of the day, it didn't change anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things where, you know, public relations, they do that. I mean, plenty of times in my career I've broke embargo dates. And you'll see people who are just, you know, the calmest, nicest people in the world go absolutely nuclear. I mean, it's just one of those things where they take a lot of, you know, perhaps excessive pride in it. You know, so much of what you do in public relations is just so, you know, regimented. It's so by the numbers. It's a day-in, day-out office job. that when you get something really exciting like that, something you actually want to go out there and throw out on the masses, you know, if information leaks out early, I think it's more than understandable for them to be a little bit upset. But at the end of the day, you know, there's some problems with the UFC in terms of their relationships with the media. I mean, we know that they're kind of secretive. We know that there are obviously a lot of, you know, questions about performance-enhancing drug testing that they're not 100% clear on. Obviously, there's a bunch of stuff involved in the Reebok deal, which never came directly forward about. Obviously, the big thing is about, you know, fighter unionization. That's another huge one that UFC will not even go anywhere near in discussing with the media.
I think that's why Dana, by the way, has blocked the half-guarded account from Twitter. I think that's all because I wrote about fighter unionization. I'm very proud of that.
Well, there goes my shot at getting a free pass to 201.
Oh, no, well, he just probably blocked it on a whim. I'm sure that he won't, that the PR people won't. They're not going to hear this shit. It'll be fine. We'll get you in somehow. Don't worry.
Yeah, we will do that. But, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, like they're like every other organization. You know, when you talk about sports and journalism and collusion and secrecy, I mean, the UFC, for all the stuff that they do or don't do, I mean, they're still nothing compared to a monolith like the NFL. They're nothing compared to a behemoth like FIFA, where if you're a beat reporter covering that, good God. I mean, Dana White is basically like the most transparent person in the world compared to, you know, international football. So, I mean, it's just really pretty much like every other agency out there. I mean, they keep things themselves. They get the information they want out there. They will do their best to keep the information they don't from circulating. And as journalists, you just kind of work with what you can guess. You fact check, you get confirmation, and that's pretty much all you can hope for.
I mean, hey, hell, Dana White is pretty much like a public relations nightmare. Like, they have a team of people who probably are on pins and needles every time he speaks, because the guy is like, I don't want to say that Dana White always tells the truth, but I think that he always tells the truth as he sees it at that moment. Like, he's willing to call Loretta Hunt a cunt. Like, you don't see Roger Goodell doing that. Like, Dana White did not take PR 101 classes or anything like that. Like, he just comes out, he will say after a show, yeah, I thought that fight sucked, or I thought that judge robbed him. And I've never, ever heard, like, hell, in other sports, if coaches come out and criticize referees, they get fined. And Dana comes out and says, that judge sucked and screwed it all up. Like, he's almost a fanboy out there at times.
Yeah, and that's really one of the things that makes covering the UFC a whole lot more interesting than covering other sports, where pretty much dealing with your bureaucracy is probably as entertaining as the actual product itself. You know, for Dana White, I mean, I think it kind of works towards your favor if you're covering UFC, because, you know, as long as all the attention is on him and his tomfoolery, you kind of get more of a free pass to kind of go in there and, you know, go out and, you know, sort of work your way around fighters, maybe skirt some of the official company policies. I remember, actually, years and years ago, I did an interview with Shane Carwin, and it was circulated on, you know, Wrestling Observer. And, I mean, it was a completely, like, non-sanctioned interview. I just, like, ran into him during a publicity stop, said, hey, I'm covering this. And we had a pretty lengthy conversation about stuff that apparently you're not supposed to kind of talk about if you're a UFC fighter, about, you know, just testing protocols and things like that. And, you know, it's one of those things where I never actually heard anything back, but just gauging by the fact that you didn't see Shane Carwin do that many interviews after that, you kind of lead to it that the fighters themselves are trained. You know, everyone kind of knows what they're supposed to say and what they're not supposed to say. And everyone has leakage, you know, especially a guy like Dana White, who's just a walking time bomb at all times. And like I said, that really kind of works towards your favor if you're covering the sport as an outsider. And
I mean, for every journalist that complains about how Dana treats them, it's like Roger Goodell, Rob Manfred, what's his name from the Gary Bettman. None of them are ever giving you guys quotes like Dana White does. Like, he is a journalist's dream as far as creating stories and giving you a good soundbite. Like, there is no head of a major organization anywhere that will give you basically a soundbite that you can write for 2 weeks on, like Dana White is.
Yeah, I wish more organizations would have more interesting public officials like that. You know, you're not going to get that with the NBA. You're not going to get that really with Bellator. I mean, Scott Coker, I'm sure he's a nice guy, but he's really, really bland. You know, he just seems like just another, you know, figurehead. With Dana White, I mean, he's a guy where he's the person he reminds me of. Obviously, I'm a huge Raiders fan. So, Al Davis. Whenever I think of Dana White, that's who I think of. Just a complete maverick. A dude who doesn't really care about the rules, who will go out and say whatever he wants, who's not afraid to have a lot of enemies. And that's probably going to hurt him in the long haul, but it just has this aura. I mean, UFC is a multi-billion dollar company, but it has still this sort of renegade atmosphere to it. I mean, you get this feeling when you're watching UFC product that you're watching something that isn't corporate, even though, I mean, it's the ultimate corporate sport. I mean, you got guys, you know, with Reebok patches on their equipment. You got Bud Light and Harley Davidson plastered all over the ring. It's a complete sellout sport, but just because of, you know, Dana White's personality and his stamp on the brand, that you kind of walk away that it's still something renegade, that you're still kind of watching the same stuff you're watching in 1995. And I think that's one of those things where it's completely commendable. I still don't know how he's able to pull that off. You can have this big multi-billion dollar, multi-year cable deal, but you still kind of feel like you're ECW.
That's one. I can't top that. That's the best way to stop, to, you know, end discussion about Dana White and to completely pivot with no segue at all. I have no way to actually turn this elsewhere. But you are one of the people I see a lot on Facebook talking about this, and it's something that I think doesn't get talked about enough, and that is basically I sense from you, and if I'm wrong, just tell me I'm wrong, because obviously I'm a moron, and we all know it, that Bernie Sanders supporters are potentially very dangerous in the world.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing. Back in November, we had Bernie Sanders swing by for a stop in Atlanta. He did a sold-out speech at the Fox Theater. And I'm one of those guys where I just want to know what's going on in culture. I want to kind of get a grasp of a pulse of all these cultural movements. And when I went out and I talked to the kids, I mean, when I say kids, I mean their kids, like 16 and 17-year-olds who aren't even old enough to vote yet. And to me, they always seem to kind of come from these very strangely privileged backgrounds. Like, for all the stuff you hear about them fighting Wall Street and hating the oligarchy and all the Occupy Wall Street banter, I mean, these are kids who are living out in the suburbs. You know, they're listening to Public Enemy and spouting, you know, the work of Che Guevara, but, you know, they have trust funds. They don't have to worry about, you know, going out there and fighting for themselves. And I think they're the kind of people who are absolutely, utterly obsessed with the fantasy of being oppressed because they've never actually felt it in their own lives. And just speaking with them, I get this feeling these are people, and I mean, it's not just Bernie Sanders. You see it in every political movement. You go talk to the Donald Trump crowd, you're going to find the exact same kind of people. You talk to the hardcore Hillary Clinton supporters, you're going to get the same thing. It doesn't matter what movement. But I think with the Sanders crowd specifically, there's just this undercurrent of just violent rage, just non-directional. It's just an entire sort of generational, you know, anger towards existence itself that, you know, they're not really happy with their lives. These are the kids who went out and spent, you know, $100,000 on a worthless bachelor degree in finger painting.
Hey.
Oh, sorry about that. Maybe macaroni art, too. Don't want to, you know, keep it too restricted here.
No, macaroni art would involve cheese, and cheese would involve the exploitation of cows for their milk, and that would be against veganism.
Yeah, we certainly can't have that.
No, but it's funny you say all that, because before you and I started, I recorded a little bit, and I was talking about Muhammad Ali, and I have this theory, basically, that obviously the people like you and I were not alive during the, you know, 60s, 70s revolution and all that shit. And I see a lot of people today who have glamorized what they thought were the Vietnam protests, and they're so desperate to recreate it that they're looking for boogeymen everywhere. And Donald Trump is a hell of a boogeyman, no doubt. But they want an armed conflict. They want 1968 in Chicago to be revisited in Philadelphia. Like, they think that that's, you know, if you don't go out on the street and get hosed down and have a dog attack you, that you're not doing it right. And they don't realize, like, we've all kind of grown up and we don't do things that way anymore.
What I'm seeing is this very, very strange combination of individuals who want to simultaneously be incredibly empowered, but at the same time victimized. And it's one of those things where I think when you're trying to achieve those two extremes, that you're kind of stuck in a rut you can't get out of. I mean, these are people who clearly are not struggling to make the world a better place. I think they're just people who, you know, have grown up with too much. I mean, you know, they have all the money in the world. They have all the creature comforts. They've never really faced adversity. And because their lives are so easy, but they're also so unfulfilled, that they're looking for anything to kind of, like you said, target as a boogeyman. And, you know, living out there in today's world, I mean, everybody is jockeying for victimization status. Everybody, to some degree, doesn't matter what subculture you belong to, you know, you're just trying to kind of position yourself as, you know, the downtrodden, that you want to go out there and take down, you know, the political other, and basically, you know, start some sort of mini-revolution. Revolutions don't happen. I mean, eventually what happens is these people, you know, either stay stuck in their parents' basement until they're 40, or eventually they grow up like everybody else and find out that you really can't trust your faith in politicians. That if you want to make the world a better place, it's not a top-down thing. Government doesn't make it happen. Society in general doesn't make it happen. If you want a good life, you got to create one for yourselves. And I think looking at the Sanders supporters and many of the Trump supporters and a lot of the Clinton supporters, it's a bunch of people who are just desperately, desperately trying to find anyone but themselves to give them a good life. And unfortunately, when you can't find that within yourself, sometimes explosions happen.
I look at it as... I do this from time to time. I'm going to actually start ramping up just for my own amusement, but I would be willing to bet that a lot of people who are upset, be they Trump, Sanders, or Clinton supporters, have never gone to a local town hall meeting. They've never actually tried to change anything at the local level, and that's where it really should matter. Like, it doesn't, because of the way the system's been, like, slowly eroded, where we've just ceded so much power to, you know, an oligarchy over there in Washington, D.C., this mishmash of, you know, all these giant groups that don't give a crap. But if you're not even willing to try to go to downtown to your local city hall and fix a speed limit sign that's bullshit like the one I have to deal with, where it goes from 35 to 25 at the bottom of fucking hill and the cop sits there every morning at 6 a.m. But, you know, these are things you can do, and if people don't do that, why should we care what they have to say about big things?
I mean, nobody really wants personal responsibility anymore. I mean, you want to put in as little effort as possible and always have some convenient scapegoat to blame for why you never accomplished anything. And, you know, you just see it across the board. Well, and I think you're pretty accomplished, though, Mike. I mean, you're basically Daredevil.
Mm. Maybe. I can see. Actually, well, I do wear glasses. But other than that, yeah, I am very much like Daredevil. It's that's a very fair assessment of my life. I am pretty spectacular, if we're being honest. But I will get back to the idea of the violence, because when Donald Trump came to Chicago, that was the first time that the violence narrative seemed to really rear its head. That Donald Trump's people were violent, but it was a lot of Bernie Sanders, because Bernie Sanders had a deal in Chicago at the same time, and they came and they publicly said, and they're proud, we're going to disrupt this thing. We're going to jump the stage. We're going to do this and we're going to do that, and so on and so forth. And for the most part, and they accomplished their goal. They accomplished the goal of making Donald Trump look violent, which is crazy to me, because again, Donald Trump, it's one of those things where I'm like, I reflexively want to be like, stop giving the guy crap, because I know the people that are against him are whack jobs, but it's Donald Trump. The dude's a fucking reality star. Like, I can't vote for a president who said, you're fired, with glee on television. Like, that just, I have to vote for Gary Johnson and pray that he gets enough votes that he can be taken seriously next time or something. I don't know. But I saw a clip on Facebook, and I've watched it dozens of times, and every time it's funnier, and it's a bunch of basically young, privileged white kids fighting each other until somebody goes, wait, we all love Bernie Sanders. Yeah! And then they all start chanting Bernie. They were fighting each other, not knowing that they were on the same side, which is insane.
You know, I keep going back to The Dark Knight. There are some people out there who just want to watch the world burn. And sometimes watch the world Bernie Sanders in this case. You know, just like I said, you know, these people, they're not really trying to make the world a better place. I remember being in college. It was very fashionable to be a part of, I can't remember the name of the organization, but it's the big social movement to end global trafficking, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're out there and you got all these kids, they have the red X's on their cars and they're having rallies and doing all these things to stop, you know, this really awful, you know, cultural blight. But then you kind of said to yourself, well, you know, if you move like 3 meters down the road, you have homeless people in your own community. I mean, the problem is not far away. It's right at your doorsteps. I mean, you can do something now to make the world a better place. And, you know, people, I think deep down there are just some individuals who really have an aversion to taking responsibility for their own actions. You know, they may say that they have an agenda, that they want to go out there and make improvements to things, but deep down, you know, they just want to instantly gratify themselves. You know, they want to feel the thrill of, you know, breaking bones or smashing windows or setting something on fire, especially if it's something they can reason is something morally acceptable. You know, that it's not, you know, vigilante justice, it's social justice. You know, it's not an immoral action, it's a very righteous moral reason. You know, we're deconstructing this horrible, you know, civil injustice. When deep down, they don't really care about doing any of that. You know, they just want to go out and, you know, have fun and break things and basically get away with doing very horrible things that they really couldn't get away if they didn't have this, you know, mass collective social ideology backing them.
It, you know, it's very intelligent the way you put that. And it's the idea, if you will, that, you know, in simplistic terms, justifying one's actions, but it is people that see, they try to figure out, I want to do X, and they figure out what they want to do in life, and then they figure out a way to make it moral, as opposed to what is the right thing to do, and then do it. Like, they want to do something, and then figure out how to pretend that it's the right thing to do, as opposed to, you know, what's right, and do that, because if you figure out what is right and try to do that, that is often way more difficult to do in life. Like, there are times when, like, I look at something and I go, the right thing to do is this, and I know it personally screws me. Like, I will lose a client, or I will take less money, or I remember I was dating a girl once, and I was talking to her mother, and I had a job opportunity come through. It's just a contracted thing for a couple months, but it had a conflicting date with an existing client of mine, and I said, I can't take this gig, even though it would have probably paid me like $10,000, and my current client was a single unwed mother who gave me $400, and I don't think I was ever going to see another dollar, but I'm like, I have my client. Like, I can't abandon her for, it doesn't matter how much money's involved. And yes, I say that to put myself over as a great guy, but in reality, like, the mom couldn't understand, well, why would you do that? Why would you just, you know, take the more expensive job? It's worth more. And I'm like, because I think that, you know, especially with the law and journalism, and I think they're very similar in many respects, there's a higher calling involved. Like, you really have to just be willing to, you know, be miserable, be poor, do whatever it takes, because you have the ultimate responsibility and job in life, and that is to tell the truth to the world. And so many people just seem to have forgotten that in life.
Yeah, I think probably one of the most beautiful moments in my life was that one completely out of the blue day where I said, you know, I've been doing something wrong with my life. not just my career as a journalist, but just getting through, you know, the day-to-day motions. And that's this idea that I've based my entire life on trying to figure out what's right and what's wrong. That you keep going back and forth about this when really, if you want to make it in the world and just really live a satisfied life, you can't really think in those black and white terms. You can't think in terms of moral and immoral. You have to think in terms of true or false. And, you know, that's the problem all journalists make. You know, when you're a student and you go in there, you think you're going to save the world, that you're going to fight, you know, corporate America and all these kids, you know, that are out there being poisoned by, you know, the environment. You go into there with this really huge chip on your shoulder, like you're some kind of superhero. And when you do that, you're destined to fail. I mean, you're just setting yourself up for disappointment because you can get out there and realize that journalism is like every other job. It's a hierarchy. I mean, it's beholden to laws. You can't go out there wearing your heart on your sleeve because if you do, number one, your work's going to suck. And number two, it's going to burn bridges. I mean, your editors are going to hate what you're doing. The people you're writing about are probably going to hate it. And you're just not going to be able to actually go up there and do what you want to do. And it took me so long to kind of figure out how to transition from that one way of seeing the world where everything was very, you know, sort of, you know, morally relativistic to being a little bit more absolute. I mean, the fact of the matter is when you're trying to make decisions on good and bad, I mean, it's never really a simple choice. I mean, it always fluctuates depending on the circumstance. So you can never really default to some sort of belief system. And I think that's the problem when you kind of look through things from, you know, that right or wrong perspective, is that for it to be consistent, you have to default to some pre-existing ideology. And whenever you do that, you're never going to make the right call because you're always going to be referring to something that you're not really basing on your own empirical observations or your own justifications or your own way of rationalizing the world. And I think, you know, just kind of moving forward as a journalist or a lawyer or really any profession, you've got to find that balance. You got to get to that point where you realize that some things are both right and true, and those are the things you should fight for.
Yeah, it's to go a little bit of inside baseball, if you will. Like, people see it pop up on halfguarded.com here and there, and we do these basically fake movie previews. Like, we look at a movie that may or may not come out one day, and we write a preview about it. We just kind of guess at it, but everybody clearly knows. I'm just guessing what Grown Ups Part 3 might be, but that gets a lot of, like, it gets a disgusting amount of traffic. Like, it's embarrassing to see how much traffic Grown Ups 3 or Dracula 2, Untold 2 will get. I'm like, I look at it sometimes and go, what the hell is going on? But whatever, like, again, it's very clearly a joke. We don't pretend like we have inside scoops, etc. And, like, I'm happy to basically allow that to float the real important stuff, which is, again, stuff like what you write, what I've written, Matt Grady's written stuff, you know, Dazza has done some outstanding work just looking at comic books from the 70s and 80s, and I'm very happy that we've kind of created a system where I don't feel like I ever have to write and, you know, send you a message and be like, yeah, I need a piece that's going to get a lot of hits. Can you write about how you think that Dana White's a racist that hates black people? We'll just go with it. It doesn't matter if it's true or not, but it'll get clicks. Like, we are never a clickbait website. We have joking comments and stuff like that, but, I mean, your piece on Mark Hunt and Brock Lesnar, that was outstanding. Like, I'm reading through it. I'm making sure everything's, you know, I do my brief spell check, although for the most part, I don't have to do much editing with your shit. I'm like, I know James has got good stuff. I throw in a picture here and there, and that's about it. And we are a unique website, and yes, I'm going to probably brag a little bit more about the thing I created. But in you know, 11 months, it went from 4,000 views in July of last year to 140,000 in the past 30 days. And I don't know how that translates to money. Apparently not a lot, but it's still like, holy crap, like, if you do good work, eventually you will find an audience. Now, we will never be the biggest. HalfGuarded.com will never be the biggest website. We will never be ESPN. I wish that you and Grady and Daza and the Comic Conversation guys and everybody else in Peach Machine, I wish I could be like, here's $5,000 a month. Let's go forth and just do whatever you want. It'll never, I don't think it'll ever happen, but which sucks, but I also take pride in knowing we all basically have reels where if you want to apply for a job, you're like, hey, look at this. It got this many hits, and look at the quality of the work. And I love knowing that it's your voice. And, you know, as I wrap up this segment on the Half-Guarded Hour here at HalfGuarded.com, I really, truly appreciate everything you've done, everything you've written, because it's been so diverse. It's been about the Raiders. It's been about Donald Trump. It's been about Brock Lesnar and Mark Hunt. You'll send me stuff, and it's so great because I have no idea what's coming. I don't know. I was like, oh, crap, where did that come from? And all of a sudden, I'm like, I got to find pictures on Google for that? I don't know what to even do for that. Like, when you wrote the piece about, again, I keep coming back to the tuition increase. It was a Kennesaw, I think it is. I'm like, what the hell? I got to find pictures for this? This is crazy. I don't know what this is, go to Georgia or go to Florida State. Like, I know those ones. And then I read the whole thing. I'm like, this is really good. And to me, it was super important because I got the impression that nobody else in the world would write about that. Because it wouldn't be a big story to anybody but students at that university, and nobody at that university was going to probably cover it and give it the attention it deserved. And to know that there was an outlet for it, I was just like, I'm so grateful, not just that you wrote it, but that you knew you could write it, that you felt the freedom to write it. And I'm so grateful to you, James, for everything you've done, everything I know you will continue to do. You are a genuine gift to the website. And so if I don't say it enough in emails, most of the time you email me pieces, I look at it, and I'm like, if I'm smart, I'll say, this is awesome. Usually I'm just like, oh, what day am I going to publish this on? Oh, it's Thursday, because I don't have a lot of stuff ready to go for Thursday. And, things like that. But you are truly, everything you've done for the site, and I've seen the other work you do for Uncommon Journalism. I'll give you a chance to plug the hell out of everything you're doing right now. But anybody who's listening to this for the first time wondering, who the hell is James? Well, why is Mike going so gaga? It's because he's legit. Like, I've been blessed by having good writers. So here you go. Do your pro-rushing shtick. Become The Rock. Become Steve Austin. Become Vince McMahon. Become Dana White. And plug the hell out of every single thing you've got going on in life.
Well, I'm trying to figure out how many F words I can cram in here. But
fuck.
You know, the thing is, obviously I do a lot of stuff. I'm the ultimate writer. That's what I'm trying to do. Malcolm Gladwell, in his book, The Tipping Point, said 10,000 hours. So it takes 10 years to actually get good at anything. So I've been professionally writing for about 6 years now, so just make another four. I'll actually, be at a point where I'm comfortable with what I'm doing. And, Half Guarded, it's such a wonderful platform. There's so much stuff that I want to write about, not just as a journalist, but just as an observer, where you could go out there and I can send my stuff to something like the Huffington Post or Cracked, and, it would get edited. It would be completely just, dwindled down into something that is completely not. And with Half Guarded, that's really the beauty of the entire site, is that you get that freedom. To use sort of a comic book analogy, Half Guard is kind of like Image Comics in the 1990s, where you get all the Marvel guys who, all the Marvel guys who didn't really kind of get the respect or didn't get to hold on to what they work and use it the way, they kind of wanted to. They didn't hold it to proprietary, ownership. So they go over there and start their own imprint where they can publish what they want, whenever they want it, how they want it, and have to worry about, all the boring politics and edits and all the other stuff going on. And, once again, everything, life is kind of funny like that. It comes full circle. And I think the reason, number one reason why I write is because I just like to give something people that entertains them. Something they can, just kind of, everything else in the world just goes away for the 15, 20 minutes they read my work. And we're talking about UFC 200 and talking about Half Guarded and really writing and journalism now. for me, this story goes all the way back to 2009 with UFC 100. And I never told you this, but that was a point in my life where I was just more depressed than I've probably ever been in my entire life. Everything just felt like it was going wrong. And I remember just one day out of the blue, I clicked on Dave Meltzer's website, and there was a preview of UFC 100 written by you about the Brock Lesnar-Frank Mir fight, and just the way you wrote it. I mean, I hadn't smiled in like a week, but just reading that, it just kind of brought me back to my senses. You know, that you don't have to be a little depressed worrywart. You know, you can go out there and create your own stuff. You can be your own person. You can create your own art. You can say what you want to say and make it artistic and entertaining and throw it out there to an audience. And, you know, it may seem like a simple thing in hindsight, but that's always kind of stuck with me. That, you know, no matter what's going on in the world, how much crap you're going on the side, all the things holding you back, if someone can create something that just makes you think a little bit harder or take, you know, the locus off yourself and your worries and kind of broaden your perspective and get you thinking about things that are happening beyond just what's going on inside your head, that can be extremely beneficial. And I've been reading your work for years and years, been a huge fan, it's been an inspiration on me, and, you know, we got a great crew here at Half Guard, and hopefully we'll just pay it forward. There's some of the kids reading it now, 10 years from now, will go up there and do their own thing, and we'll keep fighting the good fight.
Yeah, I think I told you from the very beginning, my goal has always been to basically have every single writer or podcast on the show leave. I want you to leave. I want you to get big enough that you start your own website, you know, jamesswift.com, or, you know, come up with some of those, swifty.com, I don't know, somebody clever. Like, I don't want you to be, well, I do want you to be at halfguarded.com forever, but I want you to grow and become too big for this damn site, because if you're too big for the site, that means the site's really big. And that's always been my goal, is that, you know, every single person involved in this website basically has essentially 100% autonomous freedom to say whatever they want. You have been an incredible example of it. You've written stuff. I know Peach Machine really abuses it, and I don't care. Like, he'll write about how much he hates God, and I'm like, hey, he wrote it well. It's a viewpoint. I'm not turning it down. It's just like I have like that libertarian market forces attitude towards everything, and everything you just said right now about me, I think you may have read someone else's article. There's no way anything I ever read actually resonated with anyone, but I'll take the kind words nonetheless. And but you have uncommon journalism and such. Like, talk a little bit about that before we get before we sign off.
Yeah, uncommon journalism is sort of my unofficial catch-all. You know, I've been doing basically just the weirdest or strangest or sort of the human interest stories that no one else will go to. Stuff that I've pitched towards other organizations or other places I've been writing who just wouldn't cover because, you know, it's too outside of the parameters they normally do, or it's covering, you know, topics a little bit too niche, or just not really kind of what they're looking for. So I kind of started that as a way to kind of vent way back in 2013, I believe, because I was getting a lot of stuff for my current employer, or not my current employer, but my employer back then. You know, I wasn't kind of getting as much stuff out there as I'd like. So I kind of did this sort of as a side thing, you know, sort of my quasi-protest against the system. And it's just something I kind of regularly update. You know, it's one of my things where I just like to go out there and experience the world. It gives me an excuse to talk to people and kind of go out there and cover things a lot of people don't talk about. A lot of it's just really just out there stuff. I mean, the last thing I did was about a guy who started a campaign against Taco Bell. And I've done serious stuff. I've talked to guys who were the victims of horrible abuse of children at, you know, juvenile halls in the early 1960s. You know, I've done stories about families in Georgia who are being royally screwed over by DFAC services. I've done stories, you know, about these huge, just like global issues. But I've also done stories about, you know, really simple people doing really simple things that just have a lot of personality. So that's just kind of my little Humans of New York top side project. And if anyone has a great story idea, I always want to cover it. So you can hit that up. That's going to be uncommonjournalism.blogspot.com, SUN Journalism on Twitter, and it's also on YouTube. So if you got some free time and, you know, went for half guarded to reload, where am I going to hit?
Hey, half guarded better reload quicker, Tony, if you get your ass in gear there. And, yeah, we'll try to get some more. I'll have you message me all the links. We'll put that in there. The one with Taco Bell, is that the guy that petitioned to have a certain type of food come back to Taco Bell?
Yeah, he was the guy who 5 years ago started a social media campaign to bring back the beefy crunch burrito. And he's a guy who just started this social movement, and apparently there's a whole lot more fans of the beefy crunch burrito out there than meets the eye. There's about 41,000 followers of his platform now. People that, you know, jumped out of airplanes, out of protest because Taco Bell took the menu item off. There's at least three people that we're aware of that went out and got tattoos displaying their love for the Beefy Crunch Burrito.
Wow.
So that's one of those things where it's just so weird and nobody would cover that. But I just want to go into it because it's just so out there. You know, it just tells you so much about society. And to top it all off, the guy's a really great character. I mean, he's a really sweet guy. He's got a great backstory. And it's a really great slice of life story.
Well, that's a perfect way to end this. Everybody, you need to check out James's writing. Yes, he does a lot of stuff for halfguarded.com, but Uncommon Journalism, I know it's under that creative rights thing where I can steal it, but there's some Google reason not to. I don't know what the hell the technical reasons are, but we'll make sure to link the hell out of it. He is one of the best writers out there. He is tackling subjects that very few people are willing to tackle. You are not going to be able to look at him and pigeonhole him as being A, B, or C. Like, if people know me, they go, Mike Goffin, you're basically, you're a libertarian type of guy. Like, you know what you're going to do. Like, James is a true journalist, and he's like a journalist. He gets it. He does good work, unique takes, stuff that nobody's covering, and that's what a journalist should do. Everybody in the world is covering Enron. Not everybody in the world is covering what's happening three doors down in their local town. And he's the kind of guy that's making sure that the little guy is truly protected. So, James, I really want to thank you for coming on. This went a little bit longer than I thought, but it's only 11 o'clock for you, which I totally forgot how time zones work because I'm a moron. But thank you so much again for doing the show here at halfguarded.com. And everybody, visit Uncommon Journalism. And if you don't, you will. If I see you, I'll punch you in the face. So, James, thank you so much.
The pleasure's all mine. Thank you, Mike.
All right, and we'll end like that. Thank you again, James, for everything. This was fantastic. Everything I could have dreamed of and then some.
It's my pleasure. You know, anytime you need material, I'm here for you.
Oh, that's the best thing an editor could ever hear. All right, I'll let you get going and get to sleep and all that, and I'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Take it easy.
You too. The Half-Guarded Hour here at HalfGuarded.com is proudly sponsored by Valtrex, because Valtrex has very good metrics and can tell you exactly what this audience is, and I guess all of you need Valtrex. So don't feel ashamed. It's okay. You do what you do, and it doesn't matter because Valtrex is there. So go buy some Valtrex and mention Half-Guarded Hour for a discount of some sort.